You can be a Christian and believe in evolution, because you do. And the foreword to your book is written by Francis Collins, and he does. So, yes, you can. Lots of people do. But is it logically consistent to do so? I mean, lots of people believe inconsistent things as well. So how do you reconcile Christianity and evolution?
Well, I mean, I think it's not so much a matter of reconciling them as kind of recognizing that they don't make as much contact with each other as a lot of people think. I mean, Christianity is mainly about God's revelation in Christ and how that's understood, and it's hard to see how evolutionary theory really connects to that one way or the other, either to support or refute it. And I think it's only if we get distracted by the first couple of chapters of Genesis and elevate them in importance beyond what's appropriate that we have a real conflict.
Why is it, well, then if it was only a matter of Christians believing in Jesus, then why do Christians seem so concerned about evolution and not, say, relativity or some other scientific theories?
Well, I think it's because we really would like to see ourselves as absolutely unique and on a pinnacle in the natural order, kind of separate from the rest of creation. I think that's a very attractive and intuitively self-serving position for us to be in, and evolution compromises that. I mean, as I mentioned in the book, I mean, I think we do have to kind of generalize the familiar theology of the image of God and so on, and include more of the natural world in that term. So some people are threatened by that.
But why Americans in particular, and not say Europeans?
Well, America's always been incredibly religious, and that's a very kind of complicated sociological problem. I think that America has kind of always had an entrepreneurial side to its religious fervor, and assaulting evolution turned out to be entrepreneurially successful, and so a lot of movements kind of emerged that were driven by that.
You mean there's a niche to be filled in a Darwinian sense? You could actually make money being an anti-evolutionist.
Yes, there's an ecological niche there.
That is the all-American way. Yeah, we're close in age. We both have daughters. We both went to religious schools. We both started off as creationists. And then we both abandoned creationism when we realized that we didn't know anything about evolution. When you actually study it, stuff that they tell you that it is, it just isn't the case. And yet I went on to not be religious anymore. I went to Pepperdine University, which is a Church of Christ, fairly conservative school. And you stayed religious. Why did you, down the path of abandoning creationism and challenging your religious beliefs, why didn't you just keep going and become an agnostic or atheist or whatever?
Well, there's a slippery slope, as you know, and you sort of slide off of that fundamentalist plateau down towards unbelief at the bottom, and you probably clawed your way as you were sliding down looking for something to grab a hold of and couldn't find anything. I guess I'm stuck on a bush partway down at the moment, and you know, haven't felt the need to kind of slip all the way to the bottom.
Because I'm worried, maybe I went too far in the case. And yet, you found wanting in the creation story what? I mean, just that it wasn't scientifically sound, or the biblical story itself was not fulfilling, and or that the scientific story was more enriching for you, or?
Well, I think the way the creationists spin the creation story in Genesis into this anti-evolutionary sort of proto-science just robs it of everything that's interesting. I mean, there's so many aspects to that story that are just glossed over in the creationist reading. You know, there's the repeated refrain that God looks at the world and it's good, right? I mean, this is not scientifically interesting, so the creationists don't talk about that. But that's a very meaningful part of that story, and it's something that takes that story and distinguishes it from contemporary stories in other ancient Near Eastern religions, that we are not sort of stuck here in a horrible, messy existence, but rather we're stuck here in a world that's meant to be wonderful, and so we can celebrate the good that we encounter as if it belongs here. We can celebrate the fact that we're created in the image of God and are not here to be oppressed by a pantheon of sinister deities and so on. And these are things which just get overlooked entirely in this reframing of that story to be an anti-evolutionary diatribe. And I think that Christians are kind of robbed of what's interesting in that story if we get so distracted by figuring out the the genetic characteristics of the biblical kinds and the exact sequence of the events and how long the days are.
We know we're tribal, and that although we're pro-social and cooperative within our groups, we're pretty competitive and bellicose and xenophobic against people in other groups. And so there's good research to show that, say, for example, liberal democracies and free trade between people softens up those natural xenophobic tendencies to make somebody an other, simply because you have interactions with them. And liberal democracy has a lot of transparency in it, so it's harder for people to cheat and get away with stuff. So would it not be reasonable to then say, take a political stand, I think we should spread liberal democracy as many places in the world as we can, especially in those theocratic Middle Eastern countries, because in the long run, the world will be a better place if more people practice democracy. Could you not make that argument?
Yes, but you wouldn't want to make that argument in a vacuum. I mean, if you make that argument and someone says, okay, we're going to bomb the Middle East now because it would be much easier to raise up a new generation of liberal Democrats there than try to convert the status quo, certainly no one's going to defend that. But yes, I think making the making the tribe bigger. I mean, that's what you're saying. I mean, the bigger,
right.
I mean, we have this capacity to kind of love everyone in our tribe,
right.
But we don't have any well-defined definition of how big the tribe can be. And I think if we can figure out a way to convince people that the tribe is really, really large, which would work immediately if we had an alien invasion or something like that. You know, I mean, if we thought that there was a threat from another planet that we had to deal with, then all of a sudden the whole human race is all one tribe. But that's unlikely to be the case.
You talked toward the end of your book about, spiritual implications of science or what we take out of this, and you have a quote from Carl Sagan in which he writes, "We are the local embodiment of a cosmos grown to self-awareness. We've begun to contemplate our origins, star stuff pondering the stars, organized assemblages of 10 billion, 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 I'm not going to do it, atoms, considering the evolution of atoms, tracing the long journey by which here at least consciousness arose. Our loyalties are to the species and the planet. We speak for Earth. Our obligation is to survive is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring." What's wrong with that approach? I mean, there's no God in there, and it seems deeply spiritual to me. Is there something missing from that
well,
narrative?
I think that's a possible surrogate religion for an ivory tower of scientific intellectual. But
I guess that'd be me.
Yeah, but that's hardly going to be something that will just inspire ordinary people to be attentive to their religious commitments. And I wrote a piece in Salon.com a couple months ago about that exact phenomena of trying to turn science into a religion by sort of glossing it with religious terminology there that's kind of God-free but kind of rich in spirituality and so on. And I got about 600 hostile letters within 2 weeks there.
Although that's a different venue, I suppose, than if it was a religious venue. I mean,
yes,
it.
Yes, but it was very secular, yeah. And I went after P.Z. Myers and so on there a little bit too. But I just don't think that that's would be a functional religion. And I think that when people like Carl Sagan talk that way, it doesn't worry me a bit. But if one were to kind of build a religion that was supposed to work for everybody around those beliefs, I mean, what would that be like for the people who don't really understand science very well? I mean, religion is sort of at its worst when it has the extremism, the fundamentalists and the militant violence and so on. And that never comes from the people like Carl Sagan who are religious. I mean, that comes from a different kind of person. And so what would ordinary people be like as religious adherents of that religion? I'm not so sure that that would work.
Why do you believe in God?
Why do I believe in God? I use Martin Gardner's book in actually a class I'm teaching right now, a freshman seminar. There's a part of me wants to just go with the Gardner argument and say it makes the world so much more interesting to suppose that there's a God behind it all instead of kind of nothing there. I think the mystery of God's existence is, for me, a more satisfying mystery than the mystery of how can all this rich complexity, this wonder, this extraordinary experience, how can this all just arise out of particles and laws? That seems to be very mysterious, as the existence of God is also mysterious. So I'd rather have the mysteries that come with belief in God than the mysteries that come without belief in God. But there's another side of me that feels like that belief in God actually does a little bit of work. I mean, I'm not convinced that there's a gazillion universes and that's how we should explain why this one is so bio-friendly. You know, I'm not convinced that religious experience can be all explained away as just so much evolutionary psychology coming out of our genes and our need for tribal behaviors and so on. So I find that there's a little bit of work that you can, I think, do with belief in God. And so for me, I find it creates a more satisfying worldview, and it suggests a possible explanation for some of the deepest mysteries that science really hasn't penetrated.
But you're not pretending to believe just to make life richer for yourself. You actually really believe.
Yes.
Yeah. But why? I mean, based on what? You gave a sort of a negative, okay, because there's a mystery. Yeah, okay. There's a mystery. But that doesn't mean there's a personal God who cares about us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, if you ask a question for me personally, I mean, everybody has personal histories. I mean, for me personally, I was raised believing in God. And so for me, the onus would be on someone to try to get me to stop believing. So you'd have to say, okay, here's a good set of reasons to stop believing. Now, if I had been raised an atheist and someone's trying to convince me to believe in God, you'd need another set of arguments. So there's a certain momentum that's there already, and you'd have to have some intellectual force to turn that momentum around there. So for me personally, I've just never had any reason why I wanted to abandon belief in God. But if you ask me in a more abstract sense, suppose that you don't just have this inherited belief, what reasons might you give to commend belief in God? I mean, I would say that I think there is it's a richer worldview, and I like to think that the world is a place where the good that we see belongs there and isn't just randomly popping up here and there and just misinterpreted by us as being something that titillates and is a little bit pleasurable. And I'd like to think that when we affirm, and as we do, that the world was created by God and it's a good God and it's a good world, that the world has good in it, genuine beauty, genuine happiness, and so on.
Right. I'd like to believe that too, but that doesn't make it true in some scientific sense. So you're, at some point, you're stepping off the pages of science, or you're stepping out of your role as a scientist.
Oh, I mean, just absolutely. And yeah, okay. And I think it's important to, and this was kind of in Gary's remarks at the beginning, but I think it's very important to acknowledge that there's loads and loads of things that are eminently worth believing that are not the conclusions of scientific arguments. If the only thing that we're going to be allowed to believe is something that comes at the end of a scientific argument, then we're going to have a very emaciated worldview.
But doesn't it concern you just, I mean, not concern, but just give you pause that, let's say you had been born in India instead of America, or let's say you'd been born 5,000 years ago instead of now, you wouldn't believe in Jesus. You wouldn't be a Christian. There was no such thing. So that's got to make you think, wow, I mean, if civilization had advanced quicker and there were physicists that know what we know today 5,000 years ago, they would discover the same things that we discovered. They would, because those things are actually out there to be discovered. But nobody would discover Christianity because it's a historically bound, socially created thing. It seems like we have to give you a pause for a moment. Like,
well, yes. Now, you know, I talked about having sort of slid partway down that slippery slope, you know, toward you, but not all the way down there with you. I guess in sort of the part way down that I've slipped, I mean, I'm not one who would want to argue that Christian religious experience is the only authentic religious experience.
Oh, okay. All right. What I want to know is, where do you think God steps into the system? Assuming that God is a supernatural entity of some sort, maybe outside of space and time. But to effect change in this world, at some point, he has to stick his finger into the particles and stir them up of some kind. Your book ends with a magnificent last three pages that are is rivals to anything Sagan's written. It's a beautiful thing about two particles, four forces, leptons and quarks, and weak and strong nuclear force, electromagnetism and gravity, boom. And he explains everything that ever happened in three pages with two particles and four forces, and I'm reading this going, oh my God, he's going to end up right where I ended up. And yet you don't. Where did God like pack that into the laws of nature at the beginning, and that's sort of had to unravel that way? Or does he step in every once in a while?
Well, the Templeton Foundation has funded a lot of research, and Bob Russell edited a big 10-volume set on that question. But for me personally, I like to think of the analogy of human intentionality as maybe the way to understand divine action, that we don't know how human intentionality works. You were invited to come here, and you decided that you would, and so on. And somehow, in your mind, a plan emerged, and you changed the world around you. You got onto a plane and into a taxi, and here you are now, and so on. And we don't know how that originates. There's something sort of deeply mysterious that somehow it doesn't really look like you can account for human behavior by saying it's all the consequence of prior causal streams just coming together. Somehow there's a way that you are able to manipulate the world without violating the laws of chemistry and physics and do things, get yourself from California to New York. So maybe someday we will understand that well enough to say, there's absolutely no way that God could interact with the world like that. But right now, it just seems to me that God's interaction with the world doesn't need to be any more mysterious than our interaction with the world.
I mean, you see, in your book, you seem to reject all the places where creationists think God intervenes, at the Cambrian explosion, or the rise of complex bodies, or... But maybe you'd stop at consciousness? Would you say... consciousness is a... Because intentionality here you're talking about, is this a gap that God is filling?
Well, I'm very, very leery of gaps. I mean, the history of the gaps is they all fill in.
Yep, you rejected that.
So I don't want to just kind of go and find the last remaining gap and hide in it. So I wouldn't want to say that, but I kind of suspect that there's something deep about consciousness that we just don't get. I mean, I read Daniel Dennett's book, and it was very unsatisfying. And most of these things are very unsatisfying. I mean, when you get done with them, they just don't seem to satisfy the mystery of your own experience. I mean, like, you sit and reflect on your own conscious experience, and then you read a book that describes it, and you just think, you know, that's not it. So I feel like there's going to be a radical paradigm shift if we ever do get to the point where we can talk intelligibly about consciousness, and it may be when we do that that we'll have an understanding that will say, here's how mind works in the world. And that may seem very obvious, that if there is a creator and a cosmic mind that is in and through everything, that perhaps that is the same mechanism that we can see that God's intentionality gets executed in the natural world.